Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Du findest keinen Schlaf, weil dich deine Neurodermitis wachhält? Dann denk immer daran. Du kannst eine Menge tun, um deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis zu verändern. Und du bist nicht allein. Verändere deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis jetzt. Klick dich zu allen Tipps für einen erholsamen Schlaf. schlafen-mit-neurodermitis.info.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Later in the programme, a philosophical dive into the links between life on Earth and the random events that can change it all in the depths of space.
A collision happened and this generated the fragments that are around the other asteroids. And one of those asteroids found its way to our planet.
We've also life beneath the rocks of the seabed and get excited about pinhead blobs of plankton bobbing near the ocean surface.
Every one of them, you could spend a lifetime. I often joke in the lab that you could spend 5 days at sea and you have a lifetime of puzzles to figure out.
Fish are a major source of protein for us all, especially in coastal regions of the planet. But as we heard a few weeks back, despite global efforts to manage fisheries, fish stocks are declining catastrophically. Fish farming was supposed to be the answer, rather than plunder wild species, grow the ones we eat to keep up with demand. But a series of studies in Science Advances this week puts aquaculture, or mariculture as the farming is called, under the spotlight. One paper says expansion of the practice is, quote, de-wilding the ocean and its inhabitants. I asked its authors, Laurie Sellers and Becca Franks, to explain what's wrong with fish farming.
It's definitely a dominant narrative, and it's an appealing narrative, of course, this idea that somehow we would be able to avoid the costs of fishing directly from the sea and fisheries, and instead have more control and maybe increased and optimized production through farming or aquaculture. But the best modeling that we have to date suggests that it's not operating as a replacement, but instead as an additive model, so that we're increasing production, but we're not alleviating pressure. And in fact, aquaculture itself drives some of the wild fishing in order to feed the fish that are carnivorous within aquaculture.
Sorry, so to feed the captive fish, there are still trawlers going out to get wild fish merely for the sake of making fish meal or making wild prey for them.
Exactly. So one of the bizarre things is that we're feeding carnivores. We're feeding the equivalent of top carnivores, like the equivalent of a tiger or something like that in, you know, salmon that we're fishing. And one of the primary sources of that is fisheries.
I mean, one of the words you use, in fact, the title of your paper, Laurie, is de-wilding, which is the opposite, I guess, of this modern movement of rewilding, of returning things to nature. You're saying that aquaculture, mariculture is reducing the diversity of the oceans. Give me, what do you exactly mean by de-wilding?
Yes, we see de-wilding as having four potential impacts. One is changes to the abiotic environment. So, for example, an environmental dewilding risk is through pollution from, for example, antibiotics or fish waste. Then the second kind of form of dewilding is on wildlife, and that includes wildlife at species and population level, so potentially driving marine species population loss, but also it has impacts on individual animals by, for example, posing risks of entanglement for seabirds or various marine mammals like seals. The third impact that dewilding can drive is captivity effects. Animals are placed in captivity, and that in turn obviously affects those animals. It can drive adaptations. Humans might selectively breed animals for certain production traits. And of course, the captivity conditions that these animals are kept in impact their lives and their welfare. And then lastly, the final kind of dewilding impact that we see is conceptual dewilding. So that's changes in how humans view the non-human world. And in the case of marine aquaculture, this potential eye towards farming new areas of the ocean risks, you know, changing how humans are viewing the ocean. We see it as an extractive resource to be cultivated, and we might in turn see the wild animals who are living there as pests if they are interfering with operations. Seals, for example, wanting to feed on farmed fishes.
I mean, the sort of things you're talking about, they're very familiar, I guess, from conventional farming where, you know, a forest has been cut down, some grass is grown so that you can keep cattle. That affects the land environment. Maybe other species like rats become dominant because of the disturbance and so on. But the difference is the oceans are so huge.
Yes, that is true. And that's, I think, one of the reasons for potentially farming the ocean is there is so much space. But at the same time, this is an endeavor that has not yet been undertaken by humans at a large scale. And it feels then especially important for us to assess, well, first of all, what are the already realized dewilding impacts of marine aquaculture? And what might the potential impacts be? Because if we can kind of anticipate all of these potential harms, we might make a different decision than we did in the terrestrial agriculture case. You know, we might decide, wait a second, the potential risks of expanding or intensifying marine aquaculture production might not be worth the potential benefits to humans.
I mean, Becca, some of the things that Laurie's talked about, I've heard about in the past, you know, and there are things like fish diseases being spread through fish farms into the wild and so on. Are you saying that the issue is so big that it needs this sort of high-level concept of dewilding to be taken seriously?
Yeah, I think that's just it. And part of the origin story of us working on this paper was actually just trying to organize and conceptualize and sort of make a map of the threats to the environment, the threats to animals, the threats to how we interact and relate to both. And in a terrestrial system, if we wanted to do some sort of comprehensive review of that, there is a single organizing principle, and it's called deforestation. And as we dug into the literature in the marine case, we realized there wasn't an equivalent organizing principle. That meant that all of these harms were being studied in isolation and not being connected together to create a bigger picture and a more comprehensive and I think therefore accurate understanding of what's at stake. And so by proposing this word dewilding, we think that we're going to be able to make better decisions because we'll have a more complete picture.
How serious do you think the issue is? We were talking to someone about wild fish stocks only recently, and he was saying that the situation is far more critical than people appreciate. Is that the case here, or are you just holding up a slightly orange flag to say, slow down?
That's a good question about what color the flag is. I think it's pretty clearly red. You know, really? We're losing a huge amount of life and biodiversity crash in the oceans. And one of the issues that we're facing in the 21st century is that the compounding crises from climate change, from ocean acidification, from overfishing, from habitat destruction add up to more than any single, you know, it's more than additive. And we get this emergent picture where we're really risking entire ecosystems toppling and collapsing. That is a decision point that we're at now. That is not a decision point that's in the pipe.
Becca Franks and Laurie Sellers of New York and Yale Universities, respectively, who contributed to a collection of papers on the challenges of aquaculture in Science Advances this week. Let's stay in the ocean, but put magnifying glasses on. Fish are what we see at the ocean surface, if we're lucky. But what they feed on at the bottom of the food chain are plankton, tiny, typically single-celled organisms that bob around in the water, many of them soaking up sunlight and photosynthesizing like land plants. Some have molecular propellers that can power them through the water. Others don't. They're floating blobs, yet they can still sink 150 metres or more into the depths and then rise to the top again. Think self-propelled air balloon, but water-style. We've had biophysicist Manu Prakash talk about unsung marvels of the sea before, and this week he's introducing us to the remarkable, inflatable Pyrocystis noctiluca.
A strange cell, so to say, and just like many mysteries in the ocean, this one was hiding a mystery of its own. First of all, the cell is just absolutely gorgeous and beautiful, and that's why we fell in love in the lab and we started thinking about this. It's bioluminescent, so already off the bat has something spectacular that it does. But strangely, what caught our attention is this idea that the cell has no appendage like a cilia or a flagella that could enable it to move and swim like many other dinoflagellates do. Dinoflagellates implies two flagella. It didn't have any. And ironically, all the way in the old literature, it was being reported because it had been seen in deep waters and very shallow waters in the open ocean, that it potentially could be migrating. So that's really what caught our eye and led to this spectacular discovery of inflation-induced migration.
I have to say, Manu, you're one of the few people who could make a blob of water, basically, a blob of biology, smaller than a pinhead, hundreds of kilometres out to sea, and hundreds of metres deep. And yes, you make it interesting.
You know, I have to say, it's just, I often think about every organism in the tree of life is an idea. Its way of surviving this planet has something to teach us. So to me, and to many scientists that study the tree of life as a whole, every one of them as an idea is interesting. You know, we are not in their lives as often as we would like to. And so much of these ideas remain hidden from us for a very long time.
And in this case, so the idea is that because it hasn't got any propulsion, it's using its buoyancy to move around, a bit like a hot air balloon.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. When Adam and I, Adam is a postdoc in the lab, we went on an expedition off the coast of Hawaii. And one of the spectacular things that we were able to dig in from water down below is, you know, hundreds of meters below, is this cell. And right at that moment itself on the boat, we were able to see two populations. One that somehow is going down and one that's coming up. And strangely enough, the time it makes that transition from going down to coming up, they would inflate like a hot air balloon, except they're not inflating with air. They're literally inflating with water itself, water that's just around them. That's very strange, because first of all, if you inflate, you have to change your size. And that had never been reported before. What Adam recorded in the lab was a six-fold increase in volume. That's a spectacular volume change. And what we discovered through many years of work is actually that these organisms are capable of taking in water, especially fresh water, which is less dense. And only then could you go from a sinking velocity to a rising velocity. So I often like to describe them as tiny little desalination plants of their own in a single cell, and using inflation as a mechanism to take water in and use that as a very quick slingshot to the from the bottom of the ocean to the surface.
I mean, it's very easy to imagine how I might do this as a human, but of course, the two massive differences are as single-celled organisms, these don't have a brain and these don't have muscles to do this with, but there's some kind of Is it a structural change that's involved? And it's, you know, how do they know when to move?
Yeah, there are two very key important things. First of all, if we as a human wanted to do this, you have to remember this is 6x the volume. So you would have to inflate yourself 6 times large, which is quite spectacular to think about for a single cell and not explode. And the organisms have developed a really spectacular architecture. And that architecture is not similar to a classic way when we think about a blob or a ball of material in a ball, but actually much more like an N-genus torus. So imagine a donut and drill many holes in the donut. That would make it a toroidal cell. And it's this reticulated meshwork of a cell, which is what's inflating. And only because of this particular kind of architecture can you survive inflation. Because ironically, if you were to inflate, you dilute everything. All the enzymes, all of the corresponding biochemistry is diluted away. And what we were able to show in this paper is by using this unique architecture, you can inflate yourself without ever diluting your cytoplasm. And then going back to the powerhouse for something like this, we've actually discovered, we believe there are aquaporins, these really unique molecules in the membranes that are involved in this, that are pumping and essentially transporting the water. So this is not happening through because it's a single cell. It's essentially utilizing this capacity to pump water as a mechanism to inflate.
Okay, I've heard of aquaporins. These are proteins that can draw individual water molecules through, but it's not drawing any of the salt, which would be dense. Is that the point?
Exactly. And you know, when aquaporins were discovered, they were discovered in mosquitoes, because mosquitoes take in so much blood, and then they have to pump all the water out so they can fly again, because otherwise they are too heavy. So ironically, in this case, it is also using aquaporins to lighten itself so it can take flight now, except it's underwater.
And so you have these tiny little blobs. And I mean, so they're drifting down some of the time and they're drifting up and then they're dividing, because that's the way that these kinds of plankton replicate.
Yeah, I think life has its really strange ways. What we discovered in this system is that the cell goes deep down, possibly it needs nutrients and things. That's when it's heavier than seawater. It will divide, and that division is what gives it a chance to inflate. You know, often enough in cell division, the cells that are produced are smaller, and so effectively this inflation as an event brings the size back again, and then they start rising. And then over a 7-day period, the cycle will continue. And they will make more proteins, they will get heavier, and then again the cycle continues and they would go back and divide. Because the place where they are dividing is actually quite dark. While the irony is that these cells need light to survive because they are photosynthetic. So it's the strangeness of living in light and darkness and being able to modulate and tune just the right amount of depth that you or your progeny always comes back up again. Because if you didn't rise the same distance that your ancestors sank, you're in deep trouble over millions of years.
I just sort of marvel at the work that you do, because you collect these things, you go out on a boat. I think this was off the coast of Hawaii. You throw in presumably some kind of smart bucket. You bring in, bring up water, which, I mean, these are just one of the things that presumably that you're pulling up when you do this. But every bucket has some kind of marvel for you, does it?
It really does. I mean, I think this is why I believe the ocean is one of the greatest mysteries on our planet. And we literally stare at buckets. As a lab, we go out and we have been trying to map plankton behavior. You know, these are some of the most beautiful cells that I have ever met. And every one of them, you could spend a lifetime. I often joke in the lab that you could spend 5 days at sea and you have a lifetime of puzzles to figure out.
Stanford University's Manu Prakash, the observations he and his team did on this smaller-than-a-pinhead plankton were just published in Current Biology. He was on his way to Senegal when we spoke for a completely different kind of project to field test a robust but utterly low-price malaria diagnostic. We're hoping to catch up with that next week or the week after here on Science in Action.
Du findest keinen Schlaf, weil dich deine Neurodermitis wachhält? Dann denk immer daran. Du kannst eine Menge tun, um deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis zu verändern. Und du bist nicht allein. Verändere deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis jetzt. Klick dich zu allen Tipps für einen erholsamen Schlaf. Schlafen-mit-neurodermitis.info.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news. With insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many US voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the US election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Let's keep going down here on Science in Action, down to the seabed and beyond. Only a few centimetres, but into hard rock. That's not where you'd expect to find animal life. But a team led by Monica Bright has. They're nothing too fancy, though maybe Manu would tell me not to be so sure. Simple tube worms, mollusks and so on that you can find on rocks around hydrothermal vents on the volcanic mid-ocean ridge. But these ones are underneath. How did they get there? How do they survive there? What do they do? Monica's desire to work it all out started with a rock recovered over 20 years ago by the famous Alvin deep-sea submersible on the East Pacific Rise, a black basalt with white thread-like tube worms embedded into it.
What you see is basically a rock I collected, and you can clearly see where's the surface of the rock, because this is where it's shiny. This is obsidian on the top, shiny. And then you can see that basically the tube is coming out of the side. And those animals have larvae, and once they settle, they just grow. And basically what you can see easily is where they settled, because they grow from there. And it was puzzling to me because it is below the surface, already 10 centimeters below. And I was thinking, if they come from there and they settle there, then they cannot settle when they come with the bottom water and then they encounter a vent and then they crawl down, because they are small and they cannot swim against the vent fluid flow. That is the thing that was puzzling me, and then I forgot about it.
You forgot about it. But you collected, I mean, this is an over 20-year-old sample, and it is so striking because there are these little sort of white cone-like worms with their tails deep in rock, not in mud, but deep in rock.
Yes.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, this was basically that started this crazy idea that we said maybe they do not settle from the bottom water coming from the surface water, but that they get sucked in with the cold seawater in the earth crust. And at a certain point, they meet also vent fluid that come from below. And then they just settle wherever it's good. And our idea was that they just get sucked out again, you know, and settle then.
That's a neat idea, but you are talking about exploring one of the most difficult and remote parts of the planet, the deep sea, under the deep sea floor. And that you went back so to the East Pacific Rise last year to see if you were right.
Yes, I went back that I wanted to see if I'm right or not. The experiment was designed so we can collect the larvae from the surface. But we did all this several times. And then when we wanted to collect all this, we were saying, yeah, now we need to collect the rock. And the place we have been choosing had, it was very big plates, but with cracks in it. Of course, we had the experiment over a crack. So we had really difficult to collect it. And then the pilot of the remotely operated vehicle, he took a sizzle and stuck it in the crack and opened the crack. And then we took a very large pry bar, so like a, from the ship, and we just went into there, and when we went into there, we felt like, I mean, he felt it, we saw it, that there's a hole below. And then he said, oh, maybe I can flip it. And that's what he did, actually.
So let me just picture this. So you're on the boat at the sea surface. You've got some kind of robotic ship, remote ship, a vessel down at the bottom.
Yeah.
How deep is it?
So the depth was 2,500 meters about.
Okay. And then you've got all kinds of probes and cameras and handles and things. And you're operating those. From the videos, as far as I can see, it's like you say, you were levering bits of rock off the seafloor.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's what we did. And the pilots are just very good and also very inventive. And they just flipped it. And when you flip this, you see that there's a cavity, a small cavity below, and the rock is more than 10 centimeters thick in this place. And when we looked in there, we saw that there are animals there and there are tubeworms there. And that meant immediately to me that my idea was correct, because a larvae cannot crawl down there. So it came with the seawater, and instead of going up to the surface, it just settled below. And the reality was also that when we measured the conditions below, they were, of course, very similar to the conditions above, basically.
And did you see this ecosystem, the very first rock you looked over, or did you have to...
Yes.
The first one?
At the first one, we saw it, but we saw on the ceiling, basically flipped it over, and then we looked at the ceiling of this little cavity, and we saw a lot of small tube worms, but only the tubes. So basically, in this case, the animals were dead already, but it doesn't mean anything, because if they are there, they lived at a certain time, just not at that moment anymore. And then it was clear to me, that's what they do, actually.
So if I get you right, what you're saying is you think that the larvae hatch out above the rock surface, but then because you've got all this water circulation, these tiny larvae get sucked into the cracks in the rock, and then they have to find a way to survive.
Yeah. You have to imagine that that when vent fluid is coming up, it is basically seawater that at a certain time went down. So basically, we know that the vent fluid is comes out of the surface at very discrete places, but the area where it can get sucked into the Earth's crust, to build the vent fluid, is probably much, much larger.
And do you know what they're feeding on? Is it on the chemicals in the vent fluids, or is it bacteria and other things that are down there?
Okay, so basically the larvae, first they don't feed at all because they get yolk from the mother, and they start only to feed later, and they feed on microbes, and then they settle when the place is right. And in case of the tube worms, they don't feed at all when they get larger, because immediately after they settle, the bacterial symbiont they have, that lives also in the free living environment, enters the larvae, and that organ where they finally reside is going to be built. And at the same time, when they start to fix carbon, also to produce food, they don't produce it only for themselves, but they share it with the host. And therefore, the host can reduce the entire digestive system. So they don't feed at all anymore. They cannot.
They just sit there waiting to be fed, as it were, powered by the microbes.
Yeah, their task is basically to provide the symbiont with all the chemicals they need. Like they need oxygen, they need this gas, hydrogen sulfide, CO2, so that they can fix, like, in a very similar way than the plants fix carbon with light, no?
Marine biologist Monica Bright of the University of Vienna. You'll find the details and some remarkable videos at nature.com. To finish, from life in the depths of the ocean to mass extinction from the depths of space. The first mass extinction event 450 or so million years ago in the Ordovician. It's only last month we were talking about the mounting evidence an asteroid breaking up showered the Earth with meteorites, some of them massive and making craters, but which also spread dust in near-Earth space, cooling our planet into a deadly ice age. But which asteroid, I wondered, of all the hundreds of thousands in the asteroid belt? I didn't know astronomers were already on the case, and this week they think they have found the culprit. It starts with matching the characteristics of the ancient meteorites they can hold in their hands here on Earth to rocks orbiting beyond Mars they can only glimpse through a telescope. Chrissa Avalidou was one of the sleuths.
We pass now at a stage, at a level in planetary science, that we really have to combine orbits of solar system bodies, like the small bodies, their chemistry, their composition. I would put it a bit more broadly, their composition, and the major events that occurred in our solar system, and Earth, of course, is included. So we have to put all these pieces together in order to make this puzzle. But of course, we have to work with people that they collect these small meteorites that fell on the Earth. These are our free samples. Nature gives us free samples. We don't need always billion-dollar space missions. So we have to take these free samples, put them in the lab, have a lot of measurements, and then we try to tie everything together to make a beautiful story, try to solve several important, let's say, milestones of our solar system, like the one that we are discussing today.
I mean, the measurements you get in the lab, those are a bit like the mug shots, as it were, that you might have after a crime of the person who did it. But then you have to try and match those mug shots to all the asteroids that are out in the asteroid belt. And that's quite a task, I imagine.
Exactly. This is exactly what we're trying to do. So one of the things, for example, that people, our colleagues, measure in the lab using the meteorites is that, first of all, they can study their composition. So we know the material. Another thing that they can study with a bit more complicated experiments is their chronology. What I mean about chronology? All these meteorites, they come from bigger bodies in the solar system. The first bodies that they were formed in the solar system, even before our planets, were called planetesimals. These objects were accreted directly from the protoplanetary disk, gas and dust all together. And these objects, they had different compositions depending when they were formed and where they were formed in the solar system. These objects then later, they suffered catastrophic collisions and they generated all these millions of asteroids that we see now. So because these objects broke at some point during their lifetime, they generated a lot of small fragments, meteorites, which then came to our planet and we can collect them and they can study in the lab. So by studying these things, small pieces in the lab, we can go back and understand, look inside, let's say, their original bodies, which are the planetesimals, and the intermediate bodies, which are what we call now asteroids. So what I said before about chronology is that there are some techniques that we can use in the lab where we can understand when we put them in an order, okay, we can understand when this initial planetesimal broke, or at least after which time, which epoch, right? So we have composition, we have also these measurements that they indicate the chronology. We observe now with our telescopes the physical properties of the asteroids that are in the main belt. When we have these collisions, we generate, as you can understand, families of fragments. We call them asteroid families. So all these objects, they should share similar physical properties, similar composition. They should reflect a similar amount of light from their surface and so on. So our job...
But there must be thousands.
Yes. So every breakup of a big object in the main belt can produce thousands of fragments, thousands of asteroids, right? So that's why we need a lot of observing time. We try to find them using big surveys from the ground, but also from space. And then with targeted observations, we try to study their physical properties. So what is their composition? This we do it with spectroscopy.
So basically you're comparing the colors.
Yes.
That you have to hear down on Earth of these bits of rock that have been stuffed on our surface for nearly half a billion years. You're looking at all these ones, and you've got a match is the important thing.
That's absolutely, exactly. And this is not always straightforward. So it's a very complicated work to do. And this when we succeed...
you succeed. I mean,
we are all happy.
You are. Tell me about the asteroid you think then that it came from. So which is it?
Which is precisely, I don't know, because it doesn't exist anymore.
but where did it come from?
Exactly. What we try to see is that which was the source. where it came from. As I said before, the sources of all these impactors are the asteroid families. So these groups of objects that they are generated in the main belt after big catastrophic collisions that happen between their parent asteroids. Then some of these objects, they come to the near Earth space, and some of them, they can have a bit, some nice probability to hit our planet. So the group observed several of the families, mostly in the inner part of the main belt, that could be the sources of this impactor. Here we have to keep it to our mind that we need to have similar composition, right? And we need also to have an age of the family, so a breakup event that is very similar to the time that we expect to have this phase on the Earth, this ice age on our planet. So these ages, they have to coincide, and of course the material has to match. So after doing spectroscopic observations on many families in the inner main belt, the group understood that the puzzle fits better when this family is the Massalia family. It's called Massalia. Massalia, as you understand, is Marseille, right?
Yes. Right.
So Massalia family. So nothing else fits so beautifully this puzzle.
How big is Massalia? When was it discovered? What's it, you know, what's it, is it a well-known asteroid?
Yes, it is a well-known asteroid because this is an asteroid with number 20, which means we're among the first ones since it was discovered.
Okay.
The asteroids, they have a number. Okay, when we have well estimated their orbit, they get a number. And this asteroid has number 20, which means it's between the very, very, very first ones that they were discovered.
So the idea is that it was involved in a collision more than 450 million years ago, is that right?
Exactly. A collision happened on the parent body of Massalia asteroid itself, and this generated the asteroid Massalia that we see now and the fragments that are around the other asteroids. And one of those asteroids found its way to our planet.
And that's the thing that really strikes me, is it's such a sequence of random things. An asteroid got broken up, some of its bits wandered off, some of them came to the Earth just after life was becoming interesting. You get the first mass extinction on the planet. It sort of shows how we are connected here on this planet to the rest of the solar system and the cosmos.
Absolutely. But we came from there. So because also, anyway, my specialty is also related to impacts. It's exactly what we try to do, and also colleagues try to do in the lab. We want to see how life is affected by these events. So this is a very fundamental question. So how life emerged from these big impact events, or how it was affected. So this is also a big field in astrobiology concerning at least our solar system. So everything is connected together.
Chrisa Avellino of Leicester University on the random events that link life on Earth to the unsteady clockwork of the universe. A big thought to end this edition of Science in Action from the BBC World Service. I'm Roland Pease. And I'll be back like clockwork next week with producer Alex Mansfield and another look at what's out there all around us.
Du findest keinen Schlaf, weil dich deine Neurodermitis wachhält? Dann denk immer daran, du kannst eine Menge tun, um deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis zu verändern. Und du bist nicht allein. Verändere deinen Schlaf bei Neurodermitis jetzt. Klick dich zu allen Tipps für einen erholsamen Schlaf. Schlafen-mit-neurodermitis.info.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many US voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the US election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.